We are back with the final hour of the conversation, and usually on Wednesdays during this third hour of the conversation, we welcome your favorite doctor, your favorite guest, Dr. Aaron Carroll. And of course, we always welcome your phone calls, and you should be calling the program now and throughout the hour to have your questions answered about health, health care, health policy, health insurance, healthy living. Because he's an expert on all of those things and more, including comic books, Legos, sex, hair loss, weight gain. 866-994-6343 is the phone number to join the conversation. Dr. Aaron Carroll joins us right now. By the way, on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll, his blog, very popular, The Incidental Economist, and he is a professor of pediatrics and director of the Center for Health Policy Research, Professionalism Research at Indiana University. He's the author of books that debunk myths about your body and your health, and you should get them, and you should be watching them on YouTube. Healthcare Triage is going viral, baby. All these videos are fantastic. And he's usually very well dressed in them because his wife shops for him. Good day, sir.
Good day.
I didn't love your zip up hoodie in the last video.
I swear to God, I'd live in that if I could.
Really?
I love that.
That's interesting, because I always compliment you. I'm like, that's a cool shirt, very cool shirt. But this one, a little too Darth Vader-ish. You look like a villain a little bit,
that's
I felt like.
Awesome. Well, actually, it's funny, because somebody actually commented in the comments how much they liked it. So I'll balance that out with yours. No, that's like my
thing.
Oh, wow. I would live in that thing if I could. It's so comfortable. Crazy.
I have a hooded sweatshirt like that that I never want to take off, and it's actually ugly, but I still wear it around the house all the time. It's very comfortable. It's got a fleece like inside. This is boring. Hey, what kills us? Tell us about this video. I found this video profoundly important, because of not only the statistics you lay out, but I generally don't ask you to reenact your healthcare triage videos, but this one I really got to hear why you did it and what you're trying to teach us here.
You know, it's funny because when I started to write that one, it was supposed to be something completely different, and I got totally sidetracked. I wanted to write about just in general how we misperceive risk, and without sort of trying, I just veered into this story I love to tell about the American Academy of Pediatrics and policy about putting kids on planes. That is just I learned this happened actually I think during my fellowship, and one of the guys who did the research was actually my director of my fellowship, so that was how I heard a lot about it. But you know, just going back, the American Academy of Pediatrics about a decade ago came out with this policy. And I will tell you, a lot of, unfortunately, policy that gets written by these kinds of organizations, you wish it was more evidence-based, but sometimes it's just, you know, what people think. And what they said was that they believed that the FAA should pass new rules that required all kids under the age of 2 to be in basically car seats in planes like they are in cars. Their thought was, you know, kids are in danger. You know, we put kids in car seats in cars because if they get in accidents, it prevents them getting hurt. We should be doing the same in planes. You know, we're scared to death about plane crashes. You know, we need to protect kids. This can only be a good thing. Why would anybody possibly be opposed to this? And they wrote a policy.
Oh, Mimi, call on me.
So
Yeah,
go ahead.
I can't interrupt. A car seat in a car.
Right.
Generally does the same thing a seatbelt does. It prevents you from being ejected from the automobile in a minor or even mediocre collision. However, if a car is totaled, it doesn't matter if you're wearing a seatbelt. If you get hit on the side, it doesn't necessarily matter if you're wearing a seatbelt. If you crash in a plane,
yep.
I don't know why a car seat would make any difference.
Let's follow this through.
What am I missing here? This sounds really dumb.
If I was going to make the argument, the reason we put kids in car seats is not just to keep them from ejecting from the car. It's because if they launch from the seat, even if they just hit the seat in front of them, like a missile, it could be with so much impact in their face or their head that could die. So even if they didn't get ejected from the car, they could fly through the car, hit a windshield, hit something else. That would be the concern. And the argument people are making on planes is it's the same. If they fly out of their seat and they hit a seat's way up, or if they, you know, hit the ceiling, or if they, whatever it is, they're not properly restrained. That seatbelts are not built for people of child size. That they don't properly restrain them, that they don't work. And that is why we have car seats. But So the policy was, you know, we should do this for all children. It would protect them. And, you know, of course, if one life is saved, wouldn't it be worth it, kind of thing. And what this meant was that, however, was, you know, anyone who has a child, including me, if a child is under the age of 2, you don't have to buy them a seat. You can often put them on your lap, which is a huge cost savings for a lot of people. You know, the $250, $300, $400 for an airline ticket is not a tiny amount of money for a lot of people. And so when they fly and they have small children, especially babies, oftentimes they will hold them because that's a major cost savings. Plus, it is a way to keep them quiet and asleep, and it often works. And a lot of times, even when you sort of gamble, that maybe the seat next to you will be open, in which case you could put them in the seat anyway, and you save some money. And what it turns out was that some researchers sat down and said, well, you know what, if you actually require people to now buy seats for their infants, there will be a greater than zero number who will decide they can't afford it, and they will drive instead. Because raising the price of flying by another seat, again, which is not small, will make some people drive. And here's the thing. Everybody's scared to death of flying. And almost no one is scared to death of driving. But driving is way more dangerous, way, 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 way more dangerous than flying. In fact, the number one killer of children in the United States is accidents. And car accidents kill more children than cancer and congenital malformations and the next two causes of death combined. Car accidents are a major killer of children. And so if just 5% of people decided that they were going to put their kids in the car to drive like on a 400-mile trip as opposed to flying, we would increase the number of children dying by enacting this policy. Moreover, even if we did enact it tomorrow, we could expect to save less than one half of a child's life per year. In other words, we would save maybe one child's life every 2 years at the cost of like $1.3 billion a year, which would make this the most expensive, you know, accident prevention or child, you know, death prevention program ever. Not to mention the fact that if you compare it to cars, the putting kids in car seats is like 33,000 times more effective in terms of cost effectiveness, because kids die of car accidents. They almost never die of plane crashes. Like I said, less than one child a year. So this kind of policy not only would cost a fortune and do almost no good, it would likely kill more children than it would save, because we fear the wrong things. We're all panicked about plane crashes, and we rarely think about the fact that probably the best way and the quickest way to reduce childhood death in the United States would just be never to put them in a car again. Now, of course, no one's going to do that. As we talk about all the time, we recognize that the quality of life benefit from driving around, and there is good that comes from driving, outweighs the 800 and some children who are going to die in car accidents this year. But that's fine. But that is the accidents are the number one killer of children. If you get out of the young child phase, if we look at kids like 10 to 24, I'm sorry, I think it's even like 4 to 24, the number two killer of children is suicide. And yet we never really talk about the fact that we need better mental health in the United States. It's always about, you know, panic about what they're eating or how much exercise they're getting or this or that. But the number one killer of children is suicide. The number three killer is homicide. And if we wanted to do something about that, we all know where we would start. But that's not what we do. We focus on the stuff that has nothing to do with actual harm and how we're going to die. But that is what kills us. There are objective measures of this, and they just don't match what they are for kids, nor do they match what they are for adults.
Talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll, and if you want to hear more about that, what kills us, and how we deal with risk, check out his video on YouTube, Healthcare Triage. Not only that one, but the rest of them. We've already got a number of calls, Dr. Carroll, random calls, but we still have a couple of phone lines open. You can give us a call, join the conversation. Anything you want to ask about the Affordable Care Act, health insurance, health policy, what kills us, what doesn't kill us. Brandel, is it? Is that right? Is that your name, Brandel?
No, Crandall.
Crandall. Huh. Wonder how he got that wrong. Chapel Hill, North Carolina. You're on the air with at Aaron E. Carroll. Go ahead, Crandall.
Yeah, I read about a study last week that basically the results of which suggest that the benefits of breastfeeding have been exaggerated, and I was wondering if you'd heard about that, and if so, what you thought of it.
Well, here's the thing. You know, we'll never know in sort of a way that, I mean, like, know what the quantifiable benefits of breast cancer are, because we will never be able to do a randomized controlled trial of breastfeeding. And that would be how we could figure out exactly what it does. In an ideal situation, I won't say an ideal world, but in an ideal situation, we could take, you know, 50,000 women, we could randomize half of them to breastfeed and the other half to not breastfeed, and then we could follow their children and see what actually happens to them. That's never going to happen. It's not ethical. It's not feasible. It's just not going to happen. And so,
why is it unethical? Because some people, some women won't, will choose not to.
Why don't you just? How can we possibly think it would be okay to dictate to a mother, you breastfeed, you don't breastfeed? Like, it's just not going to happen. It's just not.
Well, no, you don't dictate. You just take the ones that, choose not to.
That's not a randomized controlled trial. In a randomized controlled trial, we would, in an ideal world, we would not let them know. In other words, we like think about it if we were
Okay. Well, sir, don't you tell me what a randomized controlled trial is. I'm an expert on the issue.
So we're not going to know. So the best we can do is try to do what we call cohort studies or case control studies, or we try to do some other way to look for associations between breastfeeding and outcomes. And a lot of those studies show improved outcomes and all kinds of metrics for children who are breastfed. The problem is that so many things are confounding those kinds of studies. And it turns out that women of higher socioeconomic status often breastfeed. And really, there's no question that the kids who come from families of higher socioeconomic status do better in so many metrics than kids who don't. And it probably has very little to do with the breastfeeding and tons to do with whether or not they're from high socioeconomic status. It turns out that different, you know, ethnicities or cultures are more or less likely to breastfeed, and those kinds of things can confound it. So a lot of the studies which have been done are flawed, not because the researchers are bad or because the scientists are evil or biased, but because these studies are by their very nature imperfect. And so,
I don't even get how this ever became a controversy. How is breastfeeding any different than urinating?
Well, it's just something
that your body is supposed to do, and you're supposed to do it, and that's the end of it. How did it become?
There's nothing wrong with breastfeeding. First of all, I think breastfeeding is great, and there's a lot. I am convinced personally that the evidence is there that breastfeeding is a good thing. However, it's just not often feasible in today's lifestyle. I mean, you know, it is quick
sure.
and it's easy to judge and say everyone should breastfeed when, again, you're from high socioeconomic status and mom can take time off and you know, you can always have, like, you can be pumping and you can store it and you can have that equipment. Then it makes sense. But if you have to work, you know, two jobs, let alone, or, you know, if you don't have tons of help around the house, it can be very difficult to breastfeed, especially when you have other caregivers watching children for a significant amount of time. There's also, unfortunately, the way that it's sometimes presented, a lot of guilt associated with it. We sometimes portray it as if women are failing if they don't breastfeed, or if they can't breastfeed, or if they can't make it work, that somehow they're not doing their children right. And that creates a dynamic where there's a backlash, where women who can't or don't want to breastfeed feel that they're being talk down to, and then everybody latches onto the studies one way or the other. Bottom line is that it's like, you know, there are probably statistically significant differences in many of the studies with breastfeeding versus not breastfeeding. How big are the clinical differences? It is hard to make an argument that they outweigh the tons of other things we could do for children. I mean, a child in a well-to-do family who is bottle-fed is not going to underperform a child in a resource-needy family who is breastfed. I mean, it's not going to overcome that. They're not going to be harmed by that. Many things are more important.
Right.
But I think that there is good evidence. I mean, I do think that there is evidence that at a population level, children often have better outcomes when they are breastfed than bottle fed. But I do not think that they are clinically strong enough that I would ever want to, you know, make someone feel bad for not doing it, or to sort of judge someone who does or does not do it as being a better or worse mom.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting because the article I read said that they did it with siblings where one was breastfed and one wasn't, so it sort of controls for the factors that you're talking about.
You can, but again, those are still not perfect studies,
right?
Because again, look, there's no question in my mind that we raised our three children incredibly differently because we got better as parents. You know, our first son, we had no idea what we were doing. We completely screwed up his sleep schedule, you know, and I can still, at age 12, see behaviors in him that I believe we put into him at a young age, you know, because of what we were doing. And I think our middle child is different. Our third child, at that point, I felt like we knew what we were doing. She's completely complete, you know, she's just easy. And I don't know how much of that is me. But I can tell you all three were breastfed, and they were all for a period of time, and then they were bottle-fed after that. But, you know, everything else is the same, and they're completely different children. So, if, you know, can I say that, like, that you don't see differences in children based on breastfeeding or bottle-feeding? No. And you can do those types of studies. And, again, I do think that there probably are some differences, but we're talking again at a population level. We're talking again at, you know, very large. It's not like it's you're going to have a 10% decrease in this or a 20% increase in that. These are small, subtle differences, and sometimes in metrics that are not life changing. Like there's a lot of belief that you get better immunity from the mom. Well, that's not going to show up in a life saving measure. It might show up in the sense that you might get less colds. And you know, is that going to change a life? No. Is that probably better for you? Yeah. So these are small.
It doesn't predetermine the breastfeeding is not. Well, you've said a lot. You've pretty much explained it. Crandall, thank you so much for a very interesting question and call. Kevin in Philadelphia, you're on with at Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter. Go ahead, Kevin.
Hey, morning, guys.
Morning.
So I have a question for both of you as it's diet and exercise
Ooh.
Related. I'm sure you've heard about the CrossFit and paleo exercise diet. I don't know if it's necessarily still a fad, but thing. So I've been doing that.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, so I've been doing that for a year now. Basically, CrossFit's like high-intensity exercise, short workouts. And then the paleo diet that kind of goes hand-in-hand with it is, suppose it's shorthanded to the caveman diet. You
yep.
eat the way we were evolved to eat, which is, I don't really like to say it that way, but it's essentially lean meat and fish, lots of vegetables, some fruit, nuts and seeds, and completely cuts out dairy, processed sugar, processed carbs, and a good number of legumes. And there's some preliminary studies behind it that it changes the flora in your gut and everything. My concern is that at 33 years old and with a family history of heart disease and cancer, that me, you know, eating a pound and a half of meat a day is probably not necessarily the best thing, although we tend to get, you know, farm-raised meat and eggs and all that. So I don't know. I just wanted to know what your opinions were.
Well, these kinds of things.
The only thing I'll say is there's a great website called Paleo Hacks, Go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah. So these kinds of diets always baffle me because it's like, you know, they'll make the argument of like, this is the way the cavemen ate. You know, this is the way we were designed to eat.
We don't really know.
But not only that, first of all, yeah, but cavemen probably died really young. You know, they didn't live, I don't think they lived to be 80. Nor do I think that they were living the lifestyle we were living.
True.
I would imagine it was more active. It was a more, we have to get tons of stuff done in the first probably 20 years of our lives. Cause God
you have to follow your food around the savanna.
You're running around,
yeah.
You're chasing it. You were very active. It's like, and so, yeah, if I had to live like a caveman where I didn't know where my next meal was going to come from, it would be important to build up stores of fat. It would be important to, like, you know, have bursts of energy. And it would be important to maximize the first 20 years of my life and really not care about years 30 to 40 as much.
Right.
That is not how we live today. Today, it's like we are much more concerned with, like, yeah, is my heart at 65 going to still be clear? And is everything going to keep pumping along at that point? You know, we are much more sedentary. We are much more looking at the long game where we have completely different goals and everything else. So the idea that somehow that we should use what was maybe back then or what would make sense, that doesn't make a ton of sense to me.
Mm-hmm. I will say for weight loss, though, I've been doing this for a year, and when I started, I was 6'5". I'm still 6'5". 6'5", and like 260 pounds, and as of this morning, I'm 6'5", and 238, so weight loss is effective.
I can mention 1,000 different diets or things you can do to lose weight.
I could go vegan and drop another 20 pounds, you know,
yeah.
by the summer.
Yeah.
But
again, it's like, let's go back to the idea. It's like in the same breath people are saying we should live like the cavemen do, and then talking about weight loss. I swear I will bet all the money in my pocket. You can't find one caveman who was obsessed with his weight, who was worried about what he looked like.
Maybe
hold on, actually, we have one. We have one here. Chris is actually a cave person,
but
and
why we would look to cavemen to, like, how do we lose weight? It's like, you know, if you're telling me you think caveman because that's an evolutionary, it makes sense to you, fine. But to say caveman to lose weight, that makes no sense at all. I'm sure that it
would be I think it's just a side benefit.
I just want to look good, caveman Olympic beach.
Yeah. Yes.
Do I look good in this loincloth? Does this strip of fabric make my ass look fat?
Except I bet that they weren't even worried about covering their ass or anything else.
That's a good point.
There's lots of ways to lose weight, including starving yourself. You know, that's not healthy. And so it's not that, like, magically finding a new way to lose weight doesn't surprise me. You know, it's like just eat lettuce and you will lose weight. That's not going to be good for you. And so,
it's called the rabbit diet. What about CrossFit?
Well, CrossFit is just a method of, like, trying to exercise and get in shape. There's, you know, the problem again is, like, in what and I don't know what you want me to say about it. Do I think
I'll tell you what? I'll take this one. I was a personal trainer for 7 years.
Whatever your opinion is.
I'll take this one. I think that everybody is we all have different bodies and we all have different histories, and our injuries matter, and your body matters, and your skeleton matters, and your genetics matter. And one thing that I think that when you get to a certain age really makes a difference is doing your best to avoid any kind of impact for too long. That said, you know, my uncle's 70 years old and he's still running every day. It depends on who you are, but I think that you got to be careful with impact more than anything else. That's really what I get concerned with for people once they get over even the age of 35, that you can try to do more low impact. So, you know, instead of running, cross country skiing, swimming, elliptical machine, cycling, and instead of jumping and all kinds of different impact exercises, you want to do things that aren't going to bang your knees and your back, especially. That's what I think.
I
but I'm not
boxing in the next few years because I do some amateur boxing. Should that, like, stop?
I mean, I think that when you hit something over and over and over with your wrist, it's not good for your wrist. It's not good for your shoulder and elbow necessarily.
No,
but there's that. I think that the just kind of aero boxing and that kind of stuff, speed bag even, that's really good. I mean, Tai Bo is if it's not high impact, is really, really good. But anything you would add to that, Aaron, you know, or anything that you would disagree with?
I think that hits most of the things in there.
All right. Kevin, thank you very much. Mario wants to go with an affordable carrot question. Mario in New Jersey, you're on with Dr. Aaron Carroll.
So, Dr. Carroll, I know you are you don't like the employer mandate, right?
Employer penalty, no.
Right. So, what have you thought about or read anything about in the 2009 House version of the ACA, they had, instead of the employer penalty, they had a payroll tax that replaced the penalty. And
really?
So.
Yeah. Really? I find it hard to imagine that they had any kind of tax associated with health care reform. But okay.
No, this is when the Democrats controlled it.
Oh, Democrats. Okay, fine. Go ahead.
This is 2009. So the idea was everybody would pay, if you didn't provide insurance, you would pay a percentage of your, like FICA taxes. I think it went up to 8% total. And there was for the small businesses, I think it started over 500,000. And basically, the idea was to get rid of the cliff that employers would keep their employees under 50, and it would mitigate the impact of part-time employees. So if you don't have keeping employees under 30 hours.
Got it. Okay, so I think that that's probably better than what we have right now. But I mean, I'm going to be just honest here. I would rather just see insurance decoupled from employment altogether. Like, I don't understand.
I agree. Let's keep this in the framework of the ACA, though, because we know that that's not going to happen anytime soon.
But see, there was a time when it could have, because you have to remember, I think it still could even, because it's like you have to remember that when McCain was running against Obama for president, McCain entirely was for decoupling insurance from employment and just changing all of the tax preferences for employer-based health insurance into a universal tax credit that everybody would get. Granted, he was eviscerated for it, and so everybody gets skittish about it, but this was something that conservatives believe in and support. It also happens to be something that progressives believe in and support. The problem is that for political reasons, we just attack each other when anyone wants to sort of undo what it is. But business would be for this. Conservatives, and I mean that with a little C, are for this, and I think liberals with a little L are for this. This is something I believe that could actually happen. There's almost no economists that I know who do not favor decoupling insurance from employment. And of all the things that we could probably get done, if we could just get some bipartisan support for it, in other words, no one's going to attack the other for it, it makes a whole lot of sense. And so I would rather see, you know, just the reason we have an employer penalty was to try to defray some of the cost of the federal government onto jobs. It has nothing to do about increasing the number of uninsured.
Right.
In fact, lots of CBO analyses show if you strip the employer penalty tomorrow, it would affect overall insurance levels very, very little.
Right, just a funding mechanism.
Right, it's just to get some money. And it's not even that much money. We're talking in the low billions. It's not major, major funding for the Affordable Care Act. And so why? You know, why are we having this war? Why are we doing things which could theoretically hurt the economy, theoretically hurt business, you know, make it harder to hire people, make them have, you know, implicit decisions about whether to make people part-time or full-time? None of that sort of makes sense in light of the fact that we're just trying to recoup some money here. We're not actually trying to do what the Affordable Care Act was about. That is completely different from the individual mandate, where if you got rid of that, it would really affect the number of uninsured in the United States, and it would sort of upend the entire way that it works. And so the employer penalty is it was there to try to get some money back. It's not a good way to do that. I don't know anyone who likes it. And so I just think that that is one of the things that if we get past this fight, would be something that probably both sides could agree that we need to do away with.
Well, I don't think this fight is ending anytime soon. So probably I would think that the most logical outcome is going to be they're just going to get rid of it.
Yeah, and I do think that they're just going to get rid of it at some point. I mean, I think that the fact that they keep delaying it, and I don't like the way that they're delaying it, but no one really has a problem with them delaying it. I mean, other than sort of using it for political purposes.
Except that Obama's a tyrant.
But I'm saying it's like I don't like the fact that he's doing it, because I think it's honest. I mean, I honestly believe this. If President Romney was in office right now and he kept delaying parts of the law like this, you know, Democrats would lose their minds. They would say it's the law of the land. So it's not the best way to be doing all of this. But the outcome is not as offensive to people writ large as it might be if he was delaying other parts of the law. Because again, no wonks I know love the employer penalty or think that it's a really great idea. It was there for political reasons. It was there to make the cost of the bill look less overall. I do agree with you. I think it could go away.
Thank you, Dr.
Today, by the way. Yeah, thanks, Mario, as always, for the call. Talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll, at Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter. The Incidental Economist is where he blogs. I want to ask you about your Medicaid zombie blog, but I don't know if you knew that the Republicans in the House are repealing Obamacare for the 50th time today.
Ooh. Did I get a prize for that?
Yeah. I think the 50th is the charm, I think, is what they say.
Blue ribbon for that one.
Medicaid zombie arguments. You co-authored this piece with the co-blogger there, the brilliant Austin Fracht. It's called Zombie Medicaid Arguments That Just Won't Die. What is this about? What do people need to know?
Well, you know, I think Paul Ryan just released a report that's, you know, the basis of support for his upcoming budget. And it basically says that, you know, all the stuff that we do in government in general doesn't help the poor very much. And while you'll
the war on poverty has failed,
any number of editorials attacking the thing as a whole. But the thing that always, you know, that I focus on and I get crazy about is that they basically, he goes on a tirade about how Medicaid, you know, hurts people. It doesn't work. It's like worse than being insured. You know, people have worse outcomes. I mean, all this, we've been doing this for so long. And at some point, you just almost get tired of it. I mean, I use the word zombie arguments when it's like, it does not matter how many times I try to beat this down. It just keeps coming back. And it's not like it's new or that there's any kind of response to what was previously said before. It's just the same argument over and over and over again. It's studies of where they show an association between Medicaid and bad outcomes versus uninsured and bad outcomes, when, of course, people who are on Medicaid are way poorer than people who are uninsured. And just being poorer will make you have worse outcomes, as I said before. And so those are associations. That is not that Medicaid causes people. I mean, it's hard even for me to work out the logic here, because how you could argue that having some insurance is worse for your health than having no insurance is mind-boggling to me. It would almost imply that, like, doctors are treating them more. I don't understand the logic. They reach for the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment, and they pull out the outcomes of hypertension or diabetes, and, you know, these sort of beliefs that somehow giving healthy people Medicaid was supposed to magically drive their blood pressure down when that was never going to happen, without focusing on the people with hypertension or recognizing that the study was underpowered. It's just the same arguments over and over again, and we've discredited them before. I'm sure we'll discredit them again, but they just, it's very, very, very hard to keep saying the same thing again and again and again, but it's hard to penetrate, I guess, the bubble, and we'll keep doing it.
We've got a ton more calls to get to with Dr. Feelgood, Dr. Aaron E. Carroll, 2 R's, 2 L's. If you're not following him on Twitter, you should be watching his videos on healthcare triage and sharing them. They've reached over a million views. Congratulations, Dr. Carroll, on his healthcare triage videos, which are just fantastic. And, of course, reading him on his blog, The Incidental Economist. We'll take a break. We'll come back with the rest of your phone calls, which are across a broad range of subjects, Dr. Carroll, from juicing to the surcharge on receipts that we're seeing certain restaurants asking for to help pay for the health insurance coverage of the waitresses working in that restaurant. Two dimes. Outrage! How dare they? We'll be right back with more Dr. Aaron E. Carroll.
Pete wants you to know he was once an accessory to a crime. A friend vandalized a mailbox. He feels bad about it. Stand up with Pete Dominic.
My wife is currently instant messaging me saying, I don't totally agree with your high-impact exercise argument. Sorry if I overgeneralize everybody. Seriously, go jump off cliffs. You'll be fine. I'm just now trolling her. All right, we're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll, joining us for the conversation, as he does in the third hour, almost every Wednesday, the smartest, most articulate healthcare, health policy expert in the nation, on planet Earth, as a matter of fact. He got that award last year. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Best Health Policy Expert on Earth award
on Earth.
Given by, what was the name of that organization that gives that award again?
The Earth Organization.
The Earth Health Policy People Organization.
No, it's all
they're
Earth.
Fantastic.
Yes, all of Earth.
Let's all of Earth, you said.
Well, I'm saying it wasn't just the health policy Earth people. It was all of Earth.
Oh, all Earthlings.
By the way, I'm enjoying the fact that your wife is attacking you and not upset at me for once. So good.
Yeah, that's a change.
Yes.
She's still going, by the way. Still instant messaging.
Go for it. Attack him all
my wife,
you like.
My wife doesn't completely understand the delay concept that she listens to on the app sometimes.
Oh, the app.
All
that
right.
Weird. Why do they have that?
I don't know. I shouldn't have brought it up because they still don't know the answer. So.
Okay.
I'm not sure. Alfred's rolling his eyes at me.
I did nothing of the sort.
Well, I didn't even look at
the
computer.
I'm driving to the gym, and then I get out of the car, and then I get set up in the gym, and I turn it on, and I'm still listening to what I was listening in the car minutes ago. Drives me crazy.
Please don't complain about it. We pay you good money to join us every Wednesday.
Okay.
Nathan in Ohio, you're on Stand Up.
Yeah, good morning, guys. Dr. Carroll, I follow my congressman from Ohio 14, House of Representatives, who tweeted out a link with a picture, which forwarded out to you and that bald guy of this.
How dare you. I just responded to him.
Nice. Florida that's giving a surcharge on the Affordable Care Act for the health insurance of its employees.
They're doing exactly what Dr. Carroll suggested they do, by the way. A number of times, Dr. Carroll said, you know, if Papa John's can't afford the cost that they're going to have to pay for health care coverage and they have to raise the cost of their pizzas a dime or two, then so be it. Who's really getting hurt by that? And so basically, are they not doing exactly what you suggested they might have to do, Dr. Carroll?
They I think is that these prices will get passed along. And, of course, this is why – this is because we demand that health insurance be run through jobs and everything else, which is what I would rather we not do, as I said earlier. But here's what makes it silly. Lots of things affect the price of doing business. You know, they could pass a new law that raises – you know, gas tax, and gas tax does fluctuate. And when gas prices go up, price of everything goes up. But nobody would put on their bill, you know, price of gas tax.
I hate when you say gas. I hate it. It drives me nuts. It's gas.
I think I do it subconsciously just to annoy you. But anyway, payroll taxes have changed over the last few years. When payroll taxes change, how much we have to charge individuals and businesses, and they probably have to change their prices. But nobody would put that on there. And even just the health insurance changes in price every year. And it goes up pretty much every year. And yet nobody says, hey, you know, Blue Cross tax, because they raised the rates and it costs now 20 cents more for me to give insurance to all my employees. I'm sticking that on. The only thing that they stick on the bill, not the cost of the food, not the cost of you know, making it, not the cost of payroll, nothing, no business cost is reflected on that bill other than the Affordable Care Act. And it looks tiny. It's 20 cents. And it's like, then it becomes silly and it becomes political. And by definition, you're going to wind up angering half of your customers. So why would you do that?
Right. Good point, bald guy. I totally forgot that he did recommend that, and we did talk about that. But
I think it's totally reasonable to raise the prices to reflect the cost of doing business. I think it's an incredibly boneheaded move to try to make your business about politics unless you are absolutely sure that 100% of your clientele favor one way or the other, because otherwise you're ticking off half the people.
Right, and it makes perfect sense.
Nathan, since you know me and I don't know you, what is your weakness that I could make fun of?
Overweight or anything? Listening to your show for 3 hours.
All right, listener guy. It's very that's only going to make you dumber but sexier. I wonder if bald guy will catch on. Keith in New York may give it a shot. We'll see.
Hey there. So, yeah, I agree with Dr. Carroll on that one, to list the ACA but not the amount of money it takes from people breaking dishes or glasses is just, you know, picking and choosing what they're choosing to put on the bill. Everything costs something in a business, and everybody pays for it.
Right.
But, you know, and by the way, excellent video. And the FAA still puts cigarette ashtrays in bathrooms, even though no smoking is allowed on flights, because they are the one place where reality trumps everything else. And if you sneak a smoke in a bathroom, you to have an ashtray rather than burn down the plane.
Right.
And, you know, I just love the FAA for that. But my question was about the ACA. I was reading something yesterday about how insurance companies might adapt to the ACA going forward, and one of the suggestions was that they would buy hospitals or healthcare providers and sort of become the entire healthcare package. So instead of, you know, something like Luxottica for eyeglasses, which most people don't know about, they own the iMed insurance company. They own Pearle Vision and LensCrafters. They own all the, you know, distribution channels for most of the glasses people wear. Is there something where health insurance can become this one giant system?
It already exists. I mean, this existed before the ACA. Think about Kaiser, you know, out on the West Coast.
Right.
You know, it's the insurance company, it's the hospital system, it's the doctors, it's a vertical. HMOs often run like this, where,
But is the fact, I guess more specifically, the fact that it's putting caps on how much can be spent, but not caps on, you know, how much people are charging, that they will be more tempted to move away from a pure insurance model where they're getting squeezed to a model where they can, you know, make the profits from the high bills.
It is, there's good parts and bad parts to that. So, you know, it is tempting in the sense that, say, I think, you know, you're sort of bringing a lot of things there. One is the medical loss ratio, the idea that, you know, they can't take more than, say, 15% of premiums and spend it on stuff other than health care. So they're limited. All they can do is raise the overall rates. Of course, when you raise the overall rates, you're theoretically driving away business. So there is, you know, a sense there. So there are insurance companies that are saying, well, if we owned the entire system, then we could make money even on the healthcare side. And that model has existed for a long time. There are, as I said before, lots of examples of this throughout the country. The downside is that insurance companies know how to do insurance, and the big ones are really good at it. You know, they make money, not huge amounts of profit, but year after year, they have the numbers, they know how it works. When you take on the medical side, that is a very different business, and that is not a guaranteed slam dunk, you're going to make a ton of money. There are times when hospital systems and doctors do very well. There are times when hospital systems and doctors fold. And so I don't think it is a slam dunk that every insurance company is going to say, oh my God, we got to start acquiring hospital systems. Because, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, there was this, all of a sudden everybody was trying to gobble up and become the biggest hospital system around, and then they all started to crash. Managed care was the same thing. Doctors thought, I can get into this insurance gig too. That was the whole managed care debacle, was they realized they can make a ton of money if they sort of, you know, ran the thing from top to bottom. But then they realized they weren't good at it and went exposed to the risk, and they didn't make it. Tons of them imploded and went out of business and went bankrupt. And so there's a chance that this will happen, but don't oversell it. You know, there's a lot of downside to each of these individual markets, and businessmen are usually pretty savvy, you hope, about what they're good at and what they're bad at. The big insurance companies know where their strengths are, and I think that they will not be so eager to just start acquiring new business. Their profit margins aren't huge. They're just not.
Keith, I let you go because the background noise there. Sorry, buddy. You got to put us on mute when you're listening. Tina Winsett just tweeted to us, aren't restaurants adding a surcharge to tabs jumping the gun? The mandate doesn't even take effect till next year, does it?
Nope. And so they're just starting to, like, you know, they're either saying what they think it's going to be, or they're just claiming, as so many people do, that, oh my God, my insurance went up in cost this year. Look what the ACA did, ignoring the fact.
She also writes that the restaurant, the Gators Dockside restaurant in Florida, adding that surcharge is not even providing insurance for all employees.
Well, again, I mean, just, you got to know if they're listing this one thing, it's being done for political purposes and not because of some principled response to the cost of running business. Otherwise, everything would be itemized out there. So as long as you're owning, they're like, I'm doing this because I'm doing it for political reasons, then, of course, I don't doubt that it's not grounded in any kind of reality.
Serena in Maryland wants to ask you about juicing. Is that right, Serena?
Yes. Hi, Pete. Hi, Dr. Carol.
Hi.
Yeah. Hi, my husband and I, yesterday we watched the documentary Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead, and it was excellent. And my husband,
how romantic of the two of you.
Well, you know what? We watched it with our kids, too, my 7, 4, and 2-year-old. So
Wow. We
all sat down as a family and watched it. And my husband had been talking about juicing for some time, and then, of course, after seeing this, we're just kind of sold. So I just wanted to get from Dr. Carol what he thinks about juicing, what he thinks maybe, you know, what, a 3-day or maybe a 7-day for an average person.
What is juicing? What does that mean, juicing? Does that mean fasting on just juice?
It's pretty much just juice for, say, like 3 days or 7 days or something like that.
So why are you doing it? What do you think you're going to get out of it?
Well, I know for myself, I suffer, well, not too bad, but I've for the last 6 months, I've been having some heartburn.
Okay.
And I feel, you know, even though I'm vegetarian, I know that I don't get as much vegetables and fruit. Well, I do a lot of.
Well, I hope you do. You're vegetarian. What are you eating otherwise?
I know. I do, you know, a lot of apples and things like that. But I don't do as many green leafy vegetables. We do a lot of, like, the fake veggie meats, and, you know, some of our stuff is processed. So I'm trying to move away from that, and I really do want to get more healthy stuff in our diet.
Well,
so it would be for dietary reasons.
Okay, but again, you're talking. You see, so you are saying that you want to change the way that you eat in general on a large holistic basis,
and lose weight. I do need to
lose weight. Fine, that's fine. But why does it require a 3-day or a 5-day juice, like juicing binge, to make that happen?
I don't know. That's why I'm calling.
Okay, so I would say, like, in other words, it's like that. Yours, at least, so I ask because people have very different reasons for doing it. If you told me it was to cleanse out the toxins or do something else, my response would be very different. But you're describing you want to change the way that you
eat. Well, I think for that, I mean, that is part of it as well. It just seems like it's a very clean way of eating, and I feel like I do need to kind of reset the way that I and my family have been eating.
If you believe that spending 3 days drinking nothing but juice is going to somehow jumpstart and change the way that you're eating for the rest of your life, then Fine. What's the downside? You're not going to hurt yourself in 3 days. Other than the cost, I really can't think of any major reason to tell you not to do it. I would say, however, that what you're describing there was a major behavioral change.
Right.
Behavioral change is a slow and steady process, not a
right.
So the likelihood of you radically altering your diet after just a couple days of doing something different would be like saying you spent 3 days eating way too much fat, that somehow you would be eating fat for the rest of your life, which is also very unlikely. You would probably go back to your normal eating patterns because you haven't made any major changes to your life or how you're living it or anything else. You just juiced for 3 days. And so if you want my honest opinion, I think, and this is where I'm glad my wife isn't here because she'd yell at me because I'd be rolling my eyes. But, you know, just these things are mostly about, there's some business or money behind it. They're usually sort of gimmicky. They make huge promises and they make huge claims about how great it is for you. At some point, you gotta own reality. If there was a secret cheap way to really change everyone's life radically for the better, why would I oppose that? You know, why wouldn't everybody be like, oh my God.
And there is. This is the time when we have to do our live read about the brand new juicing machine.
Why would insurance companies not cover it? Because while you could even argue that maybe the medical establishment makes money off of illness, insurance companies lose money every day on illness. So why would they not cover this? If it was really the secret to being thinner, to being better, to being happier, to being healthier, it isn't. It's not. You know, I have a rule of thumb that I tell patients all the time. As long as it takes for something to come on, to develop, is a decent estimate of a rule of thumb of how long it takes to go away. If you've been sick for a couple days, it's likely you'll be better in a couple days. But if you've been sick badly for years, you're not fixing that in 3 days or five. It's going to
all right. I had to hang up on Serena because she was doing all kinds of different things during the call. But Serena, thank you very much for the call and a great honest answer from Dr. Carroll. Mike in Philadelphia, you're on.
Hey, thanks. Love the show, Pete. Thanks, Dr. Carroll.
Thank you. You know, actor Treat Williams is a big fan of mine. I just want to throw that out there. Go ahead, Mike. Sorry.
Love it. Dr. Carroll, I had a question. Can you tell me, does the assets that a person holds, does that come into play when they're trying to qualify for Medicaid or are required to purchase health care under the Affordable Care Act? In other words, say a person doesn't report any kind of net income on a W-2, but they have $100,000 or $500,000 in the bank. Does that come into play?
So it does, I think, for certain. Yeah, I think in some ways it does, because you hear like stories about people like spending down their assets or trying to hide them to get on Medicaid when they are elderly. That happens far more rarely than you would expect. Also, you got to remember that, and this is, people make this kind of argument for welfare as well. It's not like that welfare or Medicaid is like, yeah, it's like everybody's favorite insurance. We still have a world where most people want to make more money than welfare would give you, where they want to have better insurance than Medicaid is. I think Medicaid is way better than nothing. I think Medicaid does a pretty good job. But most people, especially those with means, want the choice and the variety of physicians that comes with commercial insurance. So most people who have means like that don't try to get Medicaid. They just don't, because they don't want to sit in the, you know, in sort of like the federally mandated health clinic. They don't want to go to the federally qualified health center. They don't want to go to the community hospital. They want to go to their specialist. They want to know that they can get in right away. They want the executive health treatment, and that costs money. And Medicaid won't cover any of that. There probably are legal ways to hide your assets, to, you know, move things around, to qualify for Medicaid, even though you could afford insurance. But especially now with the Affordable Care Act here, if you just make 138% of the poverty line, you're going to get a massive subsidy to buy commercial insurance. Why would people not want that as opposed to the Medicaid? And so I think the days of trying to hide everything to get Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act really does away with that incentive, because once you hit, you know, $15,000 for, you know, $20,000 for an individual, you can get commercial insurance for way reduced prices. And so I think there's an argument to be made some people might do that, you know, try to sort of really nail the thread the needle for saying I make, you know, 300% of the poverty line or 200% of the poverty line, but that's going to be hard. It's going to be really hard. And so I just don't think we're going to see that kind of widespread fraud or that kind of widespread gimmicking in order to try to get that done.
Why is Brendan Nyhan going to drive you to drink? And don't you drink already quite a bit?
Well, maybe even more. He's a political scientist, and he writes, he does a lot of good research on how do we change people's minds and how do we combat myths and stuff like that. And he did a great study a year ago that was published in, I think it was Medical Care, and I wrote an editorial on that one, actually, where he showed that, you know, trying to convince people that death panels weren't real actually winds up hardening their position, which was bad enough. But in this one, they basically took, they did a big survey of parents, and then they gave them four different interventions, three of which were like, this is how the CDC says you should tell people that vaccines are awesome. And then a fourth one. And no matter which intervention they picked, it wound up screwing up parents' beliefs about vaccines. It either made them think that vaccines cause autism. It either made them less likely to give their kids vaccines. It either, you know, made them think that vaccines have terrible side effects. In other words, no matter what you tried to counter, they just moved on to some other belief, and it made things entirely worse, which, of course, means that what are we supposed to do to try to get parents to vaccinate their children? This really is turning into almost a faith-based argument of just, you know, they're just people who believe, you know, vaccine.
It's a crime not to vaccinate your children, potentially a crime against my child that's going to get measles because you didn't do it.
I know, but it's like,
you're very pro-vaccine, obviously, because you're, you know, you actually suggest recently that we should be drinking the vaccine in a smoothie, which I thought was quite a bizarre assertion.
No, I wouldn't.
You did not suggest that. Oh, okay.
I am very, very pro-vaccine.
Of course. All right. Well, listen, give Dr. Carroll a follow on Twitter. If you're not already, that's one way to thank him for joining us, because we don't pay him. And he's always so loyal to the program, and we appreciate that. Thank you very much for joining us today, as always, Aaron. Lots of great calls. Thank you to all the callers. Thanks, Aaron.
Anytime.
All right, buddy. I am in Washington, D.C. right now. Alfred, you're going to be down here pretty soon, right?
I'm getting
tonight.
Ready to take my choo-choo train over there.
Going out tonight. We're going to rip it up here in D.C.
We're going to bed by about probably 7:30.
Where are you guys going? We're going across the Capitol naked.
Ben's Chili Bowl?
Oh, I would like to do that.
I have a fantasy of ordering a pizza, watching TV, and passing out.
With me naked next to you.
Done.
Yay!
And done.
All right. Join us tomorrow here from D.C. We'll have Dean Obadala. We'll have Dean Baker and other guests named Dean. Thank you, Alfred, Melanie, Chris, back in New York, our interns Andrea and Tim. Think for yourself. Be the change you want to see, and I'll see you in D.C. today as I walk around aimlessly.